Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our program tonight. Dr. Richard S. Newman and his biography of Reverend Allen entitled Freedom to Profit, Bishop Richard Allen, the A&E Church, and the Black Founding Fathers. My name is Ann Minnick. I'm a trustee at the Randall Memorial Library, and I'm really glad to see this great crowd here. The first thing I'm instructed to ask is if you could please turn off your cell phones or pagers. I'd like to welcome you all here tonight. I know we have a lot of distinguished guests, and I hope you all can stay for the reception afterwards and the book signing, just so you can all visit with each other. It just makes it a great opportunity. It's a really special evening. Just a few thank yous, and then we'll have an invocation, and then I'll come back and introduce Dr. Newman to you. Let me know if that volume gets too loud or anything like that. I want to thank the Radnor Historical Society, the Garrett Hill Coalition, the Radnor Democratic Committee, and the Friends of the Radnor Memorial Library for all joining together to sponsor Dr. Newman's honorarium. I really appreciate that. I also want to thank the Wayne Hotel. They're our hospitality sponsor. And also Mainline Suburban Life is our media sponsor for the bicentennial year for this event. Most of you have a copy of a program which has the poster on the one side and then some information on the other side. I want to give special thanks to Mrs. Janet Patrick of Rosemont, who helped to co-organize the program. She did a lot of work helping to put this together. And also I want to thank Pam Sidor, Information Services Librarian and Adult Programs Coordinator, and also Ann Pagano, who's the Director of Community and Donor Relations here at the library. The program is being recorded by Radnor Studio 21, our public access TV station, and it will be in the near future available on the Radnor Historical Society website. I did have a clipboard with a pen where you could put your name and your email address on there, and if you do that, we will be able to let you know when the recording will be available online, so you can take a look at it and also advise people who aren't able to come that they would be able to see the program. There's some other notes on here. One that's very special is the display that's in the display case in the library lobby is African-American historical artifacts from Maisie Hall's collection, which a librarian at Eastern University put together, and it's really wonderful. It'll be there for the rest of this month, so if you get a chance to do that, it's really a very good collection. Also, Sam Katz, who's working on a 10-part documentary on the history of Philadelphia, wasn't able to come tonight, but I wanted to pass along information about the film that he's working on. There should be a pilot of that film available to see, and we may be doing a screening of that here at the library that is forthcoming. Reverend Mark Kelly Tyler, who is the pastor of the Mother Bethel A&E Church, was scheduled to be here and to give our invocation this evening, but he wasn't able to make it with all the Reverend Allen festivities going on this week. So Anthony Stevenson will give the invocation. He's our principal at the Radnor Middle School, so we'll have the invocation, and then I'll introduce Dr. Newman.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Before I pray, being a good A&E, I'm going to tell you, everybody has a Bible. Richard Allen would like it that way. Let us pray. O Creator of love, Creator of peace, Creator of thanksgiving, we come this evening to give thanks for one Richard Allen. But we give thanks for the foresight that he had to, when he was on his knees at St. George, to get up and to start a new revolution, a revolution that, like the wind, started off gently, but began to blow harder, to knock down oppression, to knock down bigotry, to knock down all the obstacles that were against love. And we also thank for this man of peace who comes here this evening, our author, a blessing through his pen, a blessing through his lectures, a blessing of the ability to share the history of Richard Allen. We give thanks for the opportunity that we have as a community rather to be able to come together this evening to hear this word of peace, this word of history, this word of love. In the Creator's name we give thanks. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you very much. Just want to tell sort of a very short story and then give some of Dr. Newman's biographical information. This afternoon, I drove Professor Newman over to the Radnor High School for a class visit. He visited with Carl Rosen's English class and David Wood's social studies class combined, who's about 50 or 60 students. And he raised a question, or put a question before the students: can we consider Reverend Allen as a black founder, as one of the founding fathers? I'm intrigued by Reverend Allen, not just because he lived and preached in Radnor Township for a time, but because he combined a life lived in faith together with being a dedicated, patriotic American citizen. The spirit that drove Reverend Allen in his life in part originated from the struggles he had to endure because he was African American and born into slavery. But overall, to answer the question myself, I do see Reverend Allen as a founding father, because perhaps even more so than some of our white founding fathers, his life represented American ideals of hope, truth, love of neighbor, justice, and freedom. So I invite you to consider the question for yourself: is Reverend Allen a founding father, as Professor Newman speaks about the biography, Freedom's Prophet? And I'll give you some biographical information on Professor Newman. He studied as an undergraduate at State University of New York at Buffalo and earned a bachelor's in American history. And then he went on to Brown University and earned a master's in American history, and then went to State University of New York at Buffalo for his PhD in American history. He's a professor at Rochester Institute of Technology, and some of his current projects, in addition to having published Freedom's Prophet, Bishop Richard Allen, the AME Church, and the Black Founding Fathers, he's also director of the Abolitionist Movement National Endowment for the Humanities Summer Seminar at the Library Company of Philadelphia, July through August 2006 and 2008. He's series co-editor with Patrick Rael and Manisha Sinha of Race in the Atlantic World, 1700 to 1900, that's University of Georgia Press, and also editor and contributor of Black Founders in the New Republic, William and Mary Quarterly. In addition, he also has a book forthcoming with Oxford University Press, Love Canal and the American Dream, and maybe you'll talk about that a little bit in the question and answers, because it's a bit of a different topic, but very intriguing. He has numerous peer-reviewed publications, numerous conference papers that he's given, and he's been awarded numerous fellowships. Radnor Memorial Library is honored to welcome Professor Richard Newman. Please join me in welcoming him.
Thank you all so much for coming out and for doing me the honor of listening to a few humble words about someone who I think is a really terrific person to study and is in many ways a founder of the democratic ideals we all fiercely believe in and practice. First, let me thank all of the people who have come before, particularly Ann Minicozzi and Pam Sidor, for setting this up. There's a whole list of others who have made this lecture and night possible, and I am indeed humbled to be before you tonight. It's wonderful to walk where Richard Allen walked and to visit a part of Radnor where he stayed for a couple of weeks during his early pastorate. I feel the kind of spirits of history mingling around all of us tonight. I've said this before when I've spoken in Philadelphia, but I want to conjure those friendly spirits tonight, because I think they're all looking over us and smiling right now. And I think in many ways the lecture will sort of live up to what Alan hoped would be the dream that we would all inhabit, a dream of equality, a dream of freedom and justice for everyone, a dream that encompassed black, white, male, female, people of all sorts of backgrounds in the common pursuit of justice. If you think about the way that American history is framed and taught, we start with the American Revolutionary period and these great ideals, and then we move quickly into the pre-Civil War years, and then at that moment, slavery becomes an issue, and abolitionists jump on the scene, and then, because it's the bicentennial of his birth, Abraham Lincoln magically appears and drops some nice water onto the slavery problem. And then we shoot forward into the 20th century and we try to live up to the dream that Abraham Lincoln and many white abolitionists had. Now, I know it's a little more complex than that, but if you miss this founding era that Richard Allen lived in, if you miss the struggle that he engaged in to try to raise consciousness about the problems of slavery and injustice, then I think you really miss a great opportunity to re-examine this critical problem in American history, which is race. Richard Allen lived at a time when the struggle for racial justice was alive and well, when it framed not only his life, but the lives of thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of other people, white as well as black. He lived at a time when slavery was legal not only in the South, but in most of the North. And so his dream was that one day we would see an America that was colorblind, that really believed in equality for everyone, and which someone like Richard Allen himself could actually become a leader, dare I say, even a president. And so when I voted in November, I paused for a moment. I'm not ashamed to admit that I cried in the voting booth and thought, what would Richard Allen think? People were buzzing around me wondering about Martin Luther King and Fannie Lou Hamer and Frederick Douglass, and I went all the way back to the beginning. So what I'm really talking about here is an era that most of us think we know, but hopefully through Richard Allen we can reintroduce ourselves to. And that's what I tried to do in the book, is to put Allen's life in a context that was at once familiar and unfamiliar, and to claim him as a founding father. Richard Allen and African Americans certainly do get their own history, and every February we celebrate it. But I think to segregate it over on the side of African American history, though that is important because it shines a light on people we wouldn't otherwise study, is also problematic. Richard Allen is someone who explained America to Americans. He explained democratic practice. He explained democratic theory. So once again, what I'm really trying to do is to kind of elbow out Washington and Jefferson and Madison and say there's room for some other people on this stage. And if we could draw a painting of founders, I hope it would include this man right here. And so what I want to do here over the next 30 or 35 minutes is give you a sense of Richard Allen's optimism in the first part of his activist life. Many of you might know that Richard Allen was born a slave in 1760, probably in Philadelphia, possibly in Delaware. And for the first 50 or so years of his life, in slavery and out, he had this incredible sense of optimism that he could change the world. And I think that's a remarkable thing in the 18th century when, again, slavery was normative. People in many cultures practiced it and thought that this is the way the world was. You had slaves and non-slaves, and there's not much you could do about it. And Richard Allen, along with a whole series of other black protesters, not only in America, but in places like Saint-Domingue, which became Haiti, in parts of Great Britain, in the West Indies, you had all sorts of movements aimed at upsetting this notion that slavery was okay. And so Richard Allen, I think, is in many ways an optimist until he reaches about 40 or 50. And then he starts to have some doubts. And I'll visit those for just a little bit. But I want to take you through the end of the 1790s when Philadelphia was the governing capital and what Richard Allen thought he could do. And I think this image on the screen over here is a vital part of that story, because if you look at it, it's very light. It's optimistic. Richard Allen is almost smiling, and his background, he's painted in this background in very light tones on the original, which is down at Howard University. It's actually a kind of light blue. And if you know anything about painting in the 18th century, you know a lot of it's dark and velvety and brown. It's very dour. It's enlightenment. It's rational. And so I think it's striking that when someone painted Allen, there was this aura about him, and they almost stepped back and said, wow, I got to paint him with a light background because he's just shining and bringing that sense of optimism to the painter. And so I love to start a lot of my talks with this image of Allen because I think it really encapsulates his sense of possibility in this founding era. So Richard Allen, of course, is born a slave. He is separated from his family at least once. And around the time that the American Revolution gets started, he has this profound sense of crisis, probably because his mother was sold away from him in the late 1770s. So he's a teenager, and like a lot of teenagers, he's trying to figure out what he's here on this earth for. And of course, because he's an enslaved teenager, he's all the more pessimistic about his future. And it's at this moment that the Word of God is revealed to him. And Methodist preachers have started circling around where his second master, Stokely Sturgis, lives outside of Dover in Kent County, Delaware. And they're giving these great revivalist sermons in the Methodist tradition, which are talking about shaking the foundations of not only religion, but society. And these preachers are basically saying to people that if you live in sin, if you live in a world beset by sin and iniquity, and you don't do anything about it, then you too are sinful and will probably go to an underworld which isn't so great. And Allen hears these messages, and he starts to shape them for his own ends. And so Allen's revolution really kind of occurs simultaneously with the political revolution that we all study in the 1770s. And it's interesting to think about the way that Allen, throughout the rest of his life, returns to the standards of 1776 and the Declaration of Independence, but also the parallel revolution that's occurring in the religious world and through Methodist preaching, which really revolves around something called the New Creation, which is a phrase created by religious scholars led by a wonderful and distinguished scholar of African-American religion at Vanderbilt University, Dennis Dickerson. The New Creation is a sense that through Bible learning, through Bible study, through hearing sermons on the revivalist circuit, through going through a conversion experience, you can recreate yourself and your soul, rededicate yourself to God, and become a new person. And so Richard Allen really believes in this. And as he grows up, he kind of links that to an American identity, which says the purpose of government and society is to perfect justice and equality. So when he's a teenager, Allen's mind expands to encompass these really revolutionary thoughts. And the thing that Allen does to alter his very specific circumstance of slavery in 1779 is to invite revivalist preachers to his master's home. Now, this is where we can start to talk about Allen not simply as an activist, someone whose emotions carry the day and actions speak louder than words, but we can start to speak of Allen as a thinker. And you'll see when we get to the 1790s that Allen is, you know, thinking throughout his life about how words will ramify in society, how thoughts will circulate and impact people beyond his inner circle. And so Allen knows very well what's going to happen when he invites a white revivalist preacher who's been working through this Delaware region that is bounded by his home and his livelihood. He knows that this person is going to give a speech saying to his master, "You are found wanting," and will perhaps not be so happy when God judges you in the afterlife. And so when Allen brings this preacher to his home, this is exactly what the preacher says. Alan's master trembles, and very shortly after that, he agrees to sign a freedom agreement with Richard Allen, in which, over the course of 5 years, Allen will pay his master for the privilege of liberating him, which might be called the first form of reparations, right? Master is getting paid for the freedom of their slaves. But that's of little moment to Allen, because he thinks this is a way to get my freedom, and he works so hard to live up to that agreement that he pays it off about 15 or 18 months early. He's going to take no chances. But again, I want to draw your attention to the fact that Allen has already thought this through in advance. And so, like the American Revolutionary, he's words against actions. He's thinking about where he fits in a broader world of philosophies and ideas and notions about freedom and justice. So Richard Allen is now a free person in 1783, the same year that Americans sign a peace agreement with Great Britain and form officially the independent United States. You know, they're free and clear of Great Britain. So again, interesting parallels. Richard Allen is literally free in 1783 at the same moment that America is free. And I think he really imbibes a sense of optimism from those parallels. In other words, he says, America is reborn and recreating itself just as I have been reborn and am now recreating myself as an independent person. And so he takes very seriously his the sense of mission that comes with freedom in 1783, 1784, 1785. He starts to travel around Philadelphia, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, and engages in a whole series of preaching missions or pastorates, where he stops in a local town, prays, preaches, meets local people, reveals the Word of God, and by doing that, by forming friendships, talks about a new day of race relations, not just a new day of revealed religion. And so he's sort of a walking spokesperson for racial equality at a time, again, when slavery is legal in all parts of the American Union, save Pennsylvania, which has adopted a very gradual Abolition Act in 1780, and has started to see some of the first fruits of freedom as enslaved people run away and challenge their masters. But Richard Allen is trying to address not only African Americans, but white people. And that's what brings him to Radnor at the end of 1784. On his preaching missions, he will come to towns that are majority white, that are comprised of people of all religious persuasions and backgrounds, and he will set himself down and he will preach. And the people who hear him preach in places like Radnor say, "This must be a man of God. I've never heard such preaching." Now, this is what Richard Allen says in his autobiography, but I have no reason to doubt him. After all, he's going to go on and build a church which, over the next two centuries, will become the largest denomination of African-descended people in the world. He's going to build a church which will really become a fountainhead of freedom movements. He's going to build a church which, in the 1950s, will watch pastors and religious officials go to Washington, see laws like Civil Rights Act passed in the 1950s and 60s, watch people like Martin Luther King rise up. This is a man who was there at the very start. And so I have no reason to think that he is speaking untruths. And he meets, as many of you now know, a wonderful free black couple in Radnor Township, the Water. Hopefully that is in the works to be placed over the plot of land where they had once lived. And Richard Allen stayed there not just for a couple of days, for a couple of weeks, because he felt as if the energy he was drawing from the waters and their friends and the larger for him to carry the message further and farther out there in the world. And again, that message is simultaneously one of religious creation, take a vow of conversion and you too will be a new person in the eyes of God, and reach out to your brothers and sisters of all persuasions, faiths, and races, and watch great things happen in this new America. And there's a really touching moment that I think speaks to this electricity that is circulating through Radnor. And it comes at the end of a long preaching day where Alan has been out in Radnor giving several different sermons to all sorts of different people. And he comes back and he's so tired that he sits down at the table in the Waters residence. And he cannot even get up to eat or to pray with them. And Mrs. Waters brings the table over to him. And then as he explains in his autobiography, Mrs. Waters then washes his hands or his feet with bran, which if any of you are familiar with the Gospels, is an allusion to Paul and the moment when Jesus gets down and starts to wash the disciples' feet. And it's an act of humility and prostration, which is aimed at connecting all human souls in a mission ordained by a higher power. And so to think that this moment occurred right here in Radnor, where I visited out earlier today, where Richard Allen felt a sense of communion, a powerful sense of connection with the Waters and the congregants, I think is really meaningful all these years later, because it says that the history lives on, that there's electricity circulating through these spaces, which we often mark with historical ledgers and then say, oh, something happened here, but that was way in the past. I think there's a lesson in that moment for us today, and hopefully we'll all leave here and go back to our daily lives thinking about that lesson of communion and reaching out to people beyond our normal sphere of life. In the same way, not only that Richard Allen did, but that the Waters did. So here we are in 1784, 1785. Richard Allen is starting to make a name for himself as a traveling preacher. And that's what leads us to the image you see on the screen here. Because Richard Allen attends the founding meeting of American Methodism, the organization of American Methodism in Baltimore, the so-called Christmas Conference, at the end of 1784. And because he's well known on the preaching circuit in the Methodist community, people want to get an audience with Allen. And that's when we think this portrait was painted. Allen was sort of a rising star. People were talking about him. There was a lot of buzz associated with his preaching. And so someone shoehorned him and said, I want to paint you. Or Allen compelled someone to paint him. The point is the same, whichever way you want to argue it. He was a forceful personality, even though he was a couple years outside of slavery. Think again back to 1779. He was in bondage and only dreaming of freedom. And now in 1784, 1785, he is so well known that someone wants to paint his portrait. This will be the first of three portraits painted of Richard Allen through his long life, which is nothing short of remarkable for a person of color in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. We have what we think is one image of the great black reformer and business leader James Fortin, but some people aren't 100% sure if that's him. We have one painting of Absalom Jones, Allen's great cohort in the Free African Society, and another great African-American activist in Philadelphia, but we have three of Richard Allen. So people found him perennially fascinating and compelling, and this is the first moment when people were really drawn to his personality. And Allen builds on it. I found some new information on it. So in 1786 into 1787, he is invited by the pastor at St. George's to come to Philadelphia and to help build up the African-American congregation within that church. And Allen does that. Over the next couple of years, he draws in congregants by preaching at all hours of the day on the streets of Philadelphia and really making St. George's a growing place of black worship. Allen has also, by the late 1780s, thought about organizing a reform society, which he does with Absalom Jones and other free black leaders. It's known as the Free African Society. It's one of the first black benevolent organizations in the Western world, and it's formed here in Philadelphia in 1787. Richard Allen is actually booted out of that group by 1789, because he has such a fierce determination to adhere to a Methodist discipline. There are talks of creating a Free Black Church, and there's splits within the Free African Society over going either with Episcopalians or Quakers or Methodists, and Richard Allen will not compromise with anyone. I tell you this because just as Richard Allen is legendarily stubborn for his activism before whites, so too is he legendarily stubborn in the African American community. When I was doing this project, I would happen upon documents which suggested that not everybody in the black community in the early 19th century liked Richard Allen, because he would lecture anyone and everyone if they weren't following what he thought was the true way. You're not praying enough? You're going into some midnight frolics? You're not paying enough attention to school? Richard Allen will lecture you and get in your face and talk to you at all hours of the day. And back in the late 1780s, the black community recognizes this because Richard Allen says it's Methodism. And so when I was doing the book, one of the challenges was, what's so important to Allen about Methodism? Quakers are anti-slavery, and you even have Baptists who are anti-slavery at the time, and Episcopalians who are anti-slavery, so why is he so committed to Methodism? Well, I think the answer really gets back to that sense of the new creation. He owes his sense of freedom and possibility to the Methodist Church. It's a Methodist preacher traveling the circuit that scares his master so. It's the Methodist Church which allows Allen to build a reputation and to have his portrait painted. And in Allen's eyes, it's the Methodist Church which is really going to light the fire of the world and create a reform tradition within American society that will lead to not only abolition, but full racial equality at some point down the road. So, yes indeed, he is actually booted out of the Free African Society for a little while. Now, he stays on good terms with these folks and returns to the fold from time to time. But it's there in the minutes. Richard Allen, not acting in ways that are compatible with the Free African Society, so we've had to let him go. This is also important because it's going to set the stage for the next big act in Richard Allen's life, which is the confrontation at segregated St. George's Church over by 4th Street in Old City. Richard Allen had been building up this congregation. He had been talking about forming an independent black church, and whites were against this, and some black congregants were too. Friends in the white community, allies among white philanthropists, might have prevented them from really seeing the future with clear eyes. But by the early 1790s, there was no independent black church. Even though Allen himself dates the incident at St. George's to 1787, it probably occurred in the early 1790s. I found what I think is confirmation of that in a letter at St. George's, and he says, I think it happened in 1792 or 93. So that person might have actually been there. In any event, it revolves around what we probably all know of as the most famous moment in Richard Allen's life, a moment when black parishioners were praying in areas of a segregated church where they weren't supposed to be praying, and they were pulled off their knees, and then they left. I reinterpret this in the book as a moment that didn't just happen spontaneously, but a moment which Richard Allen created. So let's go back again to his legendary stubbornness. And then to that moment in 1779 where he invites a preacher in to his master's home. It's the same thing all over again. Richard Allen is planning to create some sort of confrontation with whites. And so I would call this the first back-of-the-bus moment. You know, Rosa Parks in the 1950s is tired. We all know she had connections to the NAACP as a secretary, and she might have been really tired, or she might have been thinking about not getting up, but there's more to the story, and I think there's much more to the story at segregated St. George's. And I think it comes down to this. One way or the other, Richard Allen was going to create a revolution. And I really do believe, in his heart of hearts, he thought one possible scenario was that if black congregants go into segregated areas of the church and get pulled off of their knees, as they do, white congregants would get up and in a version of the new creation say, absolutely not, not in the house of the Lord, not in the church that Wesley, who was against slavery, created, not in my house. And they would absolutely stand up to the white pastor and say, you cannot do this. and Richard Allen would have an interfaith, an interracial congregation in the eyes not only of God, but his fellow men. That doesn't happen, and so we get the other scenario. If whites won't get up and demonstrate their opposition to this, Allen thinks, then they will realize that they have to leave this church and create their own church. And as Allen magnificently says in his autobiography and elsewhere, we never set foot in that church again. Not actually true, from what I can tell. I think Allen stopped back later on, or at least dealt with people at St. George's on a couple of occasions. But the larger point holds true. This was a great way to demonstrate the need for a black church. And so Allen starts to build his black church. So you might say, okay, that's kind of all we need to know about Allen. And this is sort of one of the stereotypes, I think, about Allen that prevailed when I first started writing the book. And I think it's actually a version which we can believe in if we want, which is Allen was thoroughly convinced of the need for black autonomy. In other words, get your own church, stay within your community, and make sure that you have a local power base. And he does believe that. But again, if Allen is truly a believer in the new creation, he has a larger mission out there, and it's to save not only black but white souls. It's to create a true Christianity, a true equality in the eyes of other Christians, in the eyes of God, and the eyes of his fellow Americans. And so very soon after he leaves segregated St. George's, he embarks on a couple of years of what I would call not only religious but political outreach to the white community. And the first opportunity he has in this regard is in the famous yellow fever epidemic of 1793. Remember, Allen and Absalom Jones and other black leaders come out to help white leaders. They claim that white leaders compel them to aid members of the white elite and the white citizenry during this devastating yellow fever epidemic in the fall of 1793. But if you read through some of Allen's comments, it's clear that he was looking for an opportunity to maybe build some bridges. Now, he's not naive, but he does think once again, maybe the Lord is opening up an opportunity here. And so this is why Richard Allen becomes such a faithful yellow fever nurse and aid worker. And it almost kills him, because Richard Allen himself comes down with the yellow fever in October of 1793. So African Americans help save the city from destruction and ruin. Allen himself almost dies, but he can say to himself, there's going to be some larger purpose, right? Once again, that vision of the new creation, of a declaration of independence finally being lived up to, will turn into a reality. And it doesn't happen, because there's a great white backlash late 1793 into 1794, where whites accuse African American nurses of aid workers of charging excessive fees for aiding them. Whites accuse the black underclass of ransacking white homes. Whites accuse blacks of acting surly and not deferring to them. And Richard Allen gets out of the hospital. I mean, it's pretty miraculous to survive the yellow fever. And he starts reading these accounts, and he reads the first official kind of pamphlet or history written by Matthew Carey, and he is outraged. And he writes his reply, which, if you will push us forward there in the overhead, is known today as the Yellow Fever Narrative, but it has the long and unwieldy 18th century sounding name of A Narrative of the Proceedings of the Black People During the Late Awful Calamity. This is Allen's attempt to set right the facts of the yellow fever. And he says, yeah, of course, some people gouged in the black community, but not a lot. And this takes attention away from the white community. People gouged in the white community. People ran away in the white community. Matthew Carey, who wrote about the yellow fever, actually ran away to Baltimore, allegedly, on business. So let's get the facts straight. And then he talks about all of the aid rendered by African Americans who put their lives on the line in this sickened city. And at the end of this pamphlet, he attaches a couple of mini addresses that I think are really important, the most significant of which is Allen's anti-slavery address. It's about 400 words, and it's Allen's first explicit condemnation of slavery, and it's his first challenge to white statesmen, politicians, and slaveholders who, again, because Philadelphia is the governing center of the United States, are gathering, sometimes with their slaves, in the city of brotherly love. And so Allen thinks he's got a great opportunity to grab their attention. And so he issues this anti-slavery challenge, saying slavery violates the Declaration of Independence, it violates God's word, and it violates the sense of citizenship that is supposed to animate the new republic. This is an experiment in self-government that is defined by equality, Allen says. And it seems as if you Americans, slaveholders, white politicians, have little faith in the word that you live by. You don't believe in equality. And African Americans are here to tell you that if you don't treat us equally, emancipate slaves, rout racial injustice, then you are no Democrats. You are no Christians. You are nothing in the eyes of the world. And so on the one hand, while this is a clear condemnation, he also kind of couches it in a patriotic cast. And I want to read to you what I think is the most stunning line, because it not only suggests that Allen is still pretty optimistic, even after all I just described to you, revolving around white racism, but because it looks forward to the 20th century and Martin Luther King. He says in the second last paragraph of his anti-slavery address, which is published in January of 1794, "If you love your children, if you love your country, if you love the God of love, clear your hands from slaves, burden not your children with them or your country." That's a remarkable phrase for several reasons, because again, he's talking about love, Christian love, the ability of people to surmount their sense of prejudice and sin and recreate themselves, just as Allen did. He is also talking in very patriotic tones. "This is my country and it's your country and we can remake it together." So he's alluding to the Declaration of Independence. Back to Richard Allen, the thinker. This is a specific reply to Thomas Jefferson, who in Notes on the State of Virginia in the 1780s had basically expressed very pessimistic sentiments about the ability of abolition to occur successfully in America because Jefferson didn't think black and white could ever live together. Jefferson, like James Madison, like Henry Clay, like the early Abraham Lincoln, is a colonizationist. He is convinced that black and white can't live together beyond slavery. Jefferson is fearful of a race war. Why? Because he says, deep in my heart, I know how bad I've treated slaves. And any normal person would seek vengeance. And so this is what is really driving Thomas Jefferson, a sense of separation. Richard Allen is saying that absolutely cannot be. Not the country I thought I believed in, and not the God I thought I believed in. I believe in equality and a future of togetherness. And so again, let me read those lines. "If you love your country, if you love your children, if you love the God of love, clear your hands from slaves, burden not your children or your country with them." It's a challenge, but it's cast in very patriotic terms, along the lines that Jefferson had suggested. Jefferson had actually said, "I tremble for my country that when I recall that God is just." And he further said, "The whole relationship between master and slave is one of despotism." And he said, furthermore, that "I really think our children in slaveholding households get the wrong lesson. They learn not about democracy, but despotism when we discipline and sell enslaved people and treat them harshly and unequally." So here's Richard Allen, the thinker, replying to Thomas Jefferson, kind of idea for idea, word for word. So this is 1794. Allen, in the 1790s, gives two other eulogies, or two other speeches, both eulogies of white figures. One is a white abolitionist who was a fellow Methodist who died in 1798, Warner Mifflin, some of you might be familiar with him, came from a slaveholding family and freed his slaves and became an itinerant preacher along the line that Richard Allen was very comfortable with. And so Allen celebrated his life and activism as further evidence that the new creation could occur. And the second eulogy is given in 1799 of an actual slaveholder named George Washington. It's the first African-American eulogy of a president. And it's the first example of black leadership addressing a white political leadership at the national level. Richard Allen is really talking to people who are kind of in George Washington's presidential orbit. So let me talk about this for just a few minutes and then I'll wrap up. Richard Allen, I discovered with the help of some friendly people over at the National Park Service, had in many ways the best reason to eulogize George Washington, because his chimney sweeping business had worked at George Washington's home at 6th and Market Streets in Philadelphia. So when you go down to what is supposed to be the recreated president's house down at 6th and Market Streets, think not only about those 9 enslaved people that Washington brought with him, and they deserve all of our memories and thoughts and prayers, but think about Richard Allen and the free black workers and apprentices who traveled there with him. What did they see when they walked into George Washington's house? Did they connect with those enslaved people? Did he get a glimpse of Washington walking across the parlor? Did he think this man is a hypocrite and a slaveholder, the so-called father of our country? I don't know. What I do know is that when Washington died, the rest of the country was in great mourning and talking about the future as if it had no purpose. Washington was the great Revolutionary War hero, the person who presided over the Constitutional Convention, and the first president of the United States. How are we going to live without him? People wonder. And there's processions and marches through Philadelphia, and Congress tells everyone to wear a black armband. And Richard Allen notices something. No one is talking about slavery, and no one is talking about blacks as fellow citizens who might want to mourn George Washington. So, in a weird kind of way, Allen thinks back to his time at Washington's house. Thinks about the 2 slaves who ran away, perhaps. Maybe thinks about the contradictions in Washington's life. And then he finds out some information that has come through the grapevine and not a lot of people are really talking about. George Washington left an emancipationist will, which, surprise, surprise, is delayed. Says, after my wife died, the slaves that are under my control, not her slaves, but my slaves through dowry that are under my control after she dies will be freed. So it's a really gradual, private manumission. And so in the privacy of Bethel Church at 6th and Lombard, we can imagine Allen being a little more critical. But Allen also saw a moment. So Allen the thinker, thinking, everyone is talking about Washington, but no one is talking about Washington the abolitionist. I can use this. I can potentially make an abolitionist argument out of Washington's death. And so he seeks to exploit Washington's death, not in any cynical way, but as a moment of reflection about slavery and racial injustice. And so he gives a eulogy of Washington in Mother Bethel Church, what becomes Mother Bethel Church. And he then goes out and finds a printer in Philadelphia who will print this eulogy. And then that eulogy is printed not only in a Philadelphia newspaper, but editors get wind of it in New York and Baltimore, and they reprint it. Yeah. And so here's Richard Allen becoming a kind of national celebrity during the time of mourning over George Washington's death. And he's the only one talking about this legacy in Washington's life. Everyone else is kind of going through the boilerplate. Revolutionary War hero, president, Constitutional Convention service. Allen says, no, none of that matters. The only things that matter are what happened at the end of his life when Washington put his affairs in order. He got rid of slavery. And it doesn't matter if it was gradual and it doesn't matter if it was delayed. He did it. That's the new creation. And whether or not Allen really celebrated that in his heart of hearts, I don't know. But he thought this is what we should be celebrating. Everyone should become an abolitionist like Washington. Thomas Jefferson, where are you? James Madison, where are you? And it's interesting. When Thomas Jefferson dies in 1826, Richard Allen's alive. He does not eulogize him. So I think this is Allen saying, I can get people's attention and I can talk to them about bondage. And if you read his eulogy of Washington, it's not any kind of simple celebration of Washington. It's actually very complex. And he cites Washington's writings. He goes back to ancient rhetoric. And he really kind of leaves Americans with a double message. He celebrates Washington, but in doing so, he also harshly condemns white citizens who don't become abolitionists. So at one and the same time, he's waving, and if I can say, he's giving the finger. He's saying to everyone, you all think that you are great Americans? That Washington would honor you? That God will celebrate you? No. Why do you think Washington emancipated his slaves? Because he was terrified of a final judgment. And that's what's going to happen to you right now. And God is watching. Never, ever forget that. And so here is Allen saying, at the end of the 18th century, I think I can change the world. I think I can get people to listen to me. And it doesn't work out that way. I wish the story in Allen's lifetime had a happy ending. In the early 19th century, white Methodists tried to take his church away from him. They actually put it up to auction. White racism rises up not only in places well away from the city of brotherly love, but in Philadelphia after the War of 1812. Colonization is one of the fastest growing movements for its promise to get rid of free blacks, not only slaves who are emancipated. It's one of the fastest growing movements in Pennsylvania in the 1820s. Richard Allen sees slavery growing in the South and the Southwest. And it's at this moment, 1817, 1824, even as late as 1830, where he starts experimenting with a more radical form of racial justice. First, he says, maybe we can go to Western Africa. Maybe we can send African Americans to the new Black Republic of Haiti in the Caribbean. In 1830, when those two options aren't really viable, he says, you know what? Maybe we can go to Canada, up north, where they will truly respect the Declaration of Independence. But in 1830, at the first convention of black leaders held at Mother Bethel Church in Philadelphia, he also mentions the Declaration of Independence once again. And so I think he dies a divided soul, convinced of the righteousness of his cause, and telling people in the black community to be pious, think of yourselves as equal citizens, and remember that God is just. But he also has started to tell people, never give up on having a safety belt. Always think that there might be some place beyond America where you can achieve racial redemption. But even when he says that, he says, bring the Declaration of Independence and the Bible with you. So he's a very, very complex man who, at the end of his life, is already prefiguring W.E.B. Du Bois' famous dictum that to be an African in America is to be at war with yourself. And so Richard Allen dies in March of 1831, never seeing racial justice in his hometown, never seeing the end of slavery in America, never seeing some of the revolutions that we can now witness. But an interesting thing happens along the way. People pick up Richard Allen's message. In the 1850s, abolitionists play on the theme of resurrection and say that Richard Allen has been seen in the South haunting the slave quarters. He's been seen in the North haunting black churches. His message is growing and living. His spirit is moving on. And so I would like to say that finally in the year 2008 and the year 2009, the world finally caught up to Richard Allen, a black founder who dedicated his life to the principles of the new creation and the Declaration of Independence. Died before he could actually see those things, but if he's hovering up there tonight with the waters, Phoebe and Caesar, I know he's looking down and smiling on all of us. Thank you very much for your time. We got some time for some questions, and again, I'll stick around and sign some books. Any question is okay, and I'll try my best to be short and to the point. Yeah.
What did he die of?
What did Richard Allen die of is the question. It's a good question. He actually lived till the ripe old age of 71, which is certainly remarkable for any person of color in this world, particularly in an urban location.
I'm tempted to say old age. The news reports at the time say he'd been ill for a couple of months, and he dies in March of 1831. In December of 1830, he actually signs his will. He probably had a will maybe before that, but that's when he gets his affairs in order. He was afflicted by some form of pleurisy earlier in life, and maybe had some form of arthritis, maybe rheumatoid arthritis. And I haven't consulted, you know. If you read the book, you realize that I didn't want to give up the manuscript and give it to my publisher because I wanted to hold on to Richard Allen as long as I could. And so when fellow academics would say, you should consult medical dictionaries to see exactly what these terms meant at the time, I said, no, people said he had arthritis, I'll take him at their word. So he had a great spirit, but I think, you know, age caught up with him and maybe some illnesses. But it wasn't anything nefarious.
Did
yes?
he have any family?
Oh, yeah. He had a wonderful and vibrant family. He was married twice. Both of his wives were members not only of the AME Church, which he creates at Bethel, but before that, members of the class meeting at St. George's, we think. His first wife, Flora Allen, was a former slave from Virginia. She died in 1801. And then his second wife, Sarah Bass, also a former slave, was someone that Allen had known going all the way back to St. George's in the yellow fever, and he marries her in the summer of 1801, had six children with his second wife. And if any of you know Catherine Dawkins, who has since retired from Mother Bethel down to Georgia, she was a sixth-generation lineal descendant of Richard Allen, used to work the Richard Allen Museum in the wonderful basement of Mother Bethel Church. And we tell these great stories about Allen family vacations in the 20th century out in Upper Darby. Allen himself had purchased property in Upper Darby, and the family had went out there even after that property was sold in the summer. So family members down to today. And it's really interesting. One quick footnote. A friend called me from Georgia and said, there's some woman who's speaking at the University of Georgia, says she's a seventh-generation descendant. I said, that must be one of Catherine Dawkins' daughters. But I lost Miss Dawkins. Wonderful, beautiful Miss Dawkins' address, so I don't know. And if any of you have that contact information, I would love it. Other questions? Yeah?
How were the churches set up before you established a black church? Blacks had special times where they had services of their own?
Great question.
Did they sit in segregated sections of the church?
At first, our best guess is in the 1770s and 1780s, when you get the rise of Methodism in America with traveling preachers, there's a lot of informality, and one of the things that attracts African Americans to the Methodist religion is not only the explicit kind of anti-slavery messages that they're espousing, but the meetings, which are interracial, a lot of intermixing, holding hands, and it's not really policed all that much. But when you start to form churches in the 1780s, you start to see rules laid down, and Richard Allen will lament this, you know, at the time. Before we were a people, he famously says, we were a people. Now that we're a people, we're not so much a people. Meaning now that we've got an organization, we have rules and segregation, and we're wearing vestments, and we have a sense of propriety. And back in the day, it was really about the Word of God. And so in the 1780s, I think you get this kind of period of flux and transition where blacks are moving into churches like St. George's thinking, wait a minute, shouldn't the rules of the preaching circuit apply? And there was certainly segregation in the preaching circuit. But particularly when they're bringing in new congregants, they're providing money for new wings of churches. Blacks help build an extension out to St. George's. They don't like it when they're told, okay, you have to at first gather along the back of the church on the wall. Or when the second floor is built, you go up to the second floor. Or you have certain times when you can preach. And I think that's one of the reasons, and Dennis Dickerson at Vanderbilt has said this more powerfully. That's one of the reasons that Allen thinks of himself not only as a black Methodist, but a real, true Wesleyan Methodist. All the other people betrayed the original principles of the religion, by adopting all these kind of codes of segregation. And that's why, in many ways, his church initially is going to be a black church, but after the Civil War and the Reconstruction era, it drops its membership rules. It's going to be a person of African descent. Yes?
We have a living connection to Caesar Waters. This is Tom Newland. They gave
that. Oh, wow. Wonderful to have you here, sir.
Direct descendant of Caesar Waters. And the Waters family was the longest landowning family in Madison Township history up until the mid-1930s.
I know the friendly spirits of the Waters are here tonight because when we were driving around, and then Nkosi kept saying, well, I hope Mr. Newland will show, but you know, I haven't heard from him, so I'm just not sure. I didn't want to say anything, but I thought, you know, there's power out there in the world, and so I hope we can talk afterwards. I do know that if you go to the other side of Radnor, you come onto these wonderful neighborhoods, and if you look at the land that the Waters owned, it stretched to, what, 5 acres? And so it encompasses really kind of half of the little village area over there, and it's just incredible to think back in the days of Richard Allen, here was this black landowner who owned really kind of a country estate and gave his house over to this young traveling preacher, Richard Allen. So I know you have some stories to tell. I'd love to hear them. Thank you. Other questions? Are you about done?
I just want to know, where was he educated?
Where was he educated? Great question to end with, because Richard Allen was not formally educated, and if you listen to white sources, a white politician runs into Richard Allen in the 1820s coming back from Harrisburg. Richard Allen was in Harrisburg trying to lobby the state government against stronger fugitive slave provisions in Pennsylvania. Slaves from Maryland would always run away to Pennsylvania, and Maryland slaveholders would always complain to the government in Pennsylvania. And so at various times in the 19th century, Pennsylvanians would think about stronger laws against runaways and these sorts of things, and Richard Allen would lobby against these things along with other black activists. And so there's this meeting between, I think it's Jonathan Roberts, who I believe is a Federalist, and at one point an abolitionist, and Richard Allen. And Roberts goes home and writes out a note to his wife saying, I met your great Reverend Allen, you know, because I think his wife was sympathetic to Allen. And, oh, he talked up really loudly, and he doesn't really speak very well, and these sorts of things. And it's I think, as much indicative of the prejudices of the time as anything. But Allen is someone who was a self-taught preacher in many ways on the Methodist circuit, and someone who learned to read and write through Bible study, maybe through friends and relatives, possibly through his children. Some of whom were educated formally. His son Richard was in the first class of seminarians in the Augustinian Society, which was created in 1816 in Philadelphia. All the black preachers got together to create a black seminary, and Richard Allen's son was among the first, and they studied geography, they studied Latin, they were being prepared for mission activity in Africa, and they were kind of representatives of uplift. And so Richard Allen actually later on writes notes in French that I think his son translated. So we can imagine Allen actually learning from his son. And this is what you see in some black households in the 19th century in the South. Children actually get formal education at certain moments, and they teach their parents. And so I think it's a marvelous way to think about Allen. I'm going to be honest, that's a guesstimation, but it's based on the evidence we have. More important, I think, is just the fact that Allen is someone who cared about words and literature and writing, and we know this because he owns several sets of biblical commentary, including the complete works of Josephus, the ancient Jewish scribe and scholar who lived during the first century AD. And so again, people like to depict Richard Allen, including members of later generations of the black church like Daniel Payne, well, Richard Allen wasn't that educated. He was an extempore preacher, spoke from the heart. Not all that true. He read what he could, had biblical commentaries, read fairly wisely, read Jefferson, read Franklin, read Washington, tried to speak in their tones on occasion. And so I think the lesson is, once again, self-improvement. The new creation is something that's not just about religion, but education. Thanks again, folks. It was great to be here tonight. An honor and honor.
I hope you'll join me again in just thanking Professor Newman for that excellent program. It's really very, very well done. Enjoy. The door on the library staff has a small gift for Professor Newman.
Wow. So great. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks again to Tim and for all the help. Thank you for coming out tonight. See you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There you go. Yeah. That's me.